smiled. That smile has quite an impact. I don't want to keep mentioning it, but, and I'm trying to be scientific about this, it produces a physical response in me every time. I feel foolish even writing that, but there we are. When he finally spoke, I became aware that I was smiling back at him like a smitten teenager. With an effort, I forced my face to adopt a more neutral expression. I've just had a thought. Babies learn to smile within a few weeks because they mirror their parents. Abel smiled at me almost immediately. Was it because I was smiling at him? Well, he's no baby, obviously. Obviously. There is something unformed about him that reminds me of a tiny infant. Well, I digress. Abel smiled at me. Then he said, I learned more about how to speak from you than I did from your colleagues. You choose different words. Your vocabulary is wider. I looked down at the ABC book and wondered how useful it would be for a man who could already use the word vocabulary correctly in a sentence. Well, thank you, Abos. And I... He seemed to search for a word for a moment. Something I haven't seen him do before now. I like you, Cress. I've always, much to my embarrassment, been someone who readily blushes. It annoys me that my body can so easily betray me. After his admission, combined with that smile, I'm afraid I blushed from the roots of my hair to my fingertips. I fought a short, fierce internal battle to regain that neutrality. Thank you, Abos. I like you too. Father said you want to learn how to read? Very much. I am learning the two primary methods of communication through daily interactions with Professors Lofthouse, McKean and Sullivan, Mr. Ainsley, Colonel Hopkins and personnel 1 to 17, but reading requires guidance if I am to master it quickly and precisely. I took a moment to review the sentence I had just heard. Two things stood out. I tackled the latter first. What do you mean by personnel 1 to 17? A long pause then. I attribute no meaning to them. Oh, let me rephrase. To whom are you referring? I'll stop mentioning the long silences. Every time I asked a question, everything ground to a halt for at least a minute, sometimes longer. When it happened, Abos never appeared to be thinking. He looked at me or around the room, blinked, scratched his nose. All normal-looking behaviour apart from the fact that any other person would have answered the question. I soon learned that he would get there in the end if I gave him enough time. As the days went on, the pauses became much shorter. They never stopped entirely. I am referring to the personnel. Hopkins said that personnel would be allocated to guard my quarters, and I have met other personnel in the mess hall. 17 discreet personnel so far. He could use discreet correctly, but didn't know the plural of personnel. I was fascinated that he had accepted Hopkins' descriptions of the soldiers and had not ascribed them the same status as individuals as he had with those he had named. I asked about the other thing bothering me. You spoke about two different primary methods of communication. What methods do you mean? Silence then. Unconscious and conscious. Body and speech. I wondered if the order he'd placed them in was deliberate. I asked him to elaborate. Most information comes from body communication. Speech adds detail. Clarification. Oh, but surely speech is more important than that. We use it in almost all communication. No. Body communication is primary. You are unaware of the extent to which you communicate through your skins. The limbs, the hands, but mainly the face. Most words confirm what has already been communicated by your body. Father tells me Hopkins is expecting the military's top psychologist to join the team. He is not going to be short of material. Abos continued. Sometimes body communication and speech contradict. This is very interesting. I cannot learn this behaviour. I do not understand its value. I wasn't sure I did either, but this was turning into a rabbit hole. I don't have the expertise to explore. I reached for the books and opened the first one, moving my chair to sit alongside him. A is for apple, I said, pointing to the letter, then the picture. A. Apple, he replied dutifully. I turned the page. B is for ball. What is ball? I was pleased that the book had prompted him to ask a question, but I began to see the challenge of using traditional picture books to teach reading to a creature who had never seen a ball. or a car, or a dog, or an elephant. We raced through the books in a few hours, despite this challenge. Abels is unlike any other student. He only needs to be told something once, so the repetition built into the books we were using was unnecessary. After I'd closed the last book in the pile, Abels made his request. Well, more of a demand, really. The tone wasn't demanding, but his intent was unambiguous.
I understand reading, but only language, only concepts. Now I must go outside.
He stood up as if we were leaving immediately. Couldn't quite suppress a smile. I was already imagining Hopkins' reaction. But who was going to say no to a 7-foot bulletproof god? I mean man. Freudian slip, dear diary. Freudian slip. Chapter 16. September 8th, 1978. I didn't get to witness Hopkins' reaction. I was told to stay home Wednesday and Thursday, and was only called back in early this morning. And when I say early, I mean to say the driver knocked on our door at 4:45 a.m. I was taken directly to the colonel's office. Hopkins was furious. Furious! If this is what he's like after a couple of days to get used to the news, perhaps it's better that I didn't see him immediately afterwards. He didn't shout and bluster. That's not his style. Hopkins is the sort of man who never threatens. I've had plenty of time to observe him, and he displays no outward signs of anger. Inexpressive man at the best of times. The only indication that he is enraged is a state of physical immobility even more pronounced than usual. He didn't ask me to sit. He was standing when I entered, and judging by the fact he was ramrod straight with his arms glued to his sides, I knew he was irate. He didn't even move his head as I entered the room and stood across the desk from him. His eyes swiveled in their sockets like a lizard's.
"You're here at the asset's request, against my better judgment, Miss Lofthouse."
"No time for hello, then."
"The asset is under the protection and supervision of Her Majesty's armed forces. Specifically, he falls under my command as head of station."
"Oh, under my command." There was so much I wanted to say, but I'm not that empty-headed.
"As do you, Miss Lofthouse, so rather than waste more of my time, here are your orders for this morning."
I bristled at that word, but, strictly speaking, he was right. I have been seconded to the military, and Hopkins is in command. I am supposed to follow orders. His moustache moved as he spoke, every hair trimmed at precisely the same length as its neighbour.
"You will accompany the asset on his trip outside this facility. The exercise will last 1 hour. You will be driven to Finsbury Circus, then on to your residence, after which you will return here for a debrief."
I stood there like a lemon for a moment, then realised what he'd said. "He's coming to my house?"
"Correct. He wants to see how people live. McKean trained as a medical doctor. He will accompany you. Major Harris will be in command. Dismissed."
He pulled a cardboard file towards him, opened it and started to read. I was so flummoxed by what he'd said that it was all I could do not to salute. Instead, I turned on my heel and walked out of his office. A short woman in army uniform was waiting for me outside.
"Miss Lofthouse, I'm Major Harris. Good to meet you. Are you ready?"
She put out her hand and I shook it, dazed.
"Oh, but you're a woman," I said.
The station was so patriarchal that the presence of a female senior officer had apparently rendered me temporarily witless.
"No, Miss Lofthouse, I'm a soldier."
She led me to the lift where McKean and Abels were waiting for us. The car journey was short but memorable. I had been watching Harris in the lift, and I have to say I was impressed by her self-control. She may have already spent a little time with Abos. I've been away for a few days, so I don't know when she arrived. She showed no overt signs of interest in him at all. She's about 5'5", a little shorter than me, and Abos towers over her, but she maintained her composure as if she sees physical specimens like him every day. Perhaps her insistence on pretending he was nothing out of the ordinary led to the problems with the car. I'm not interested in cars, so I couldn't say what make it was, but it was very big, shiny, dark grey and luxurious. The driver held open the back door for Abos and waited until he was seated before closing it. At that point it got farcical for a few minutes and I had to stifle an inappropriate bout of giggling. Major Harris directed McKean to get into the back first, then indicated that I was next, but no one had allowed for the fact that Abos was so much bigger than most people. When McKean got in, he found that Abos had only fitted in at all by turning sideways and putting one foot on the seat and the other in the footwell. With a great deal of effort, McKean managed to squeeze himself into the space remaining, but there was no way I could follow. Harris stuck her head through the open door and asked Abos and McKean to move various limbs this way and that in an attempt to make it work. It was when McKean's foot appeared out of the passenger window that I had to turn away to stop myself laughing. Fortunately, Harris is a practical woman. She'd obviously been given orders about the seating arrangements. The glass in the rear windows was dark and would conceal the car's occupants. When she realised it would not work, she sighed and made a decision.
"Okay, McKean, stay where you are. Miss Lofthouse and I will join you in the back, Mr..."
She stopped abruptly. If she'd been briefed by Hopkins, she had probably been about to call him Mr. Asset. There was an awkward silence until Abos spoke.
"Abos." "Mr. Abos, please come and sit in the front."
Even then, the front seat had to be pushed so far back that Harris was pinioned into place. The driver started the car. Two soldiers lifted the barrier to the car park, and we drove out as the sun began to rise. Abos spent the first minute or so watching the movements the driver made to control the vehicle. After he'd seen enough, he looked away and out of the window. The early morning sun was painting the dirty buildings with that magical light that makes everything it touches temporarily beautiful. There was barely another car on the streets. No one spoke as we drove. I watched this newborn man greet his first dawn, his perfect face expressionless as he drank in the sight. In a few minutes we reached Finsbury Circus, a circular green area on the site of one of London's first parks. I've often sat on the benches there, or listened to a concert in the bandstand on a sunny afternoon. Abos unfolded himself from the car and stood at the edge of the park. When the driver shut the door, there was a sudden explosion of sound as a dozen pigeons, woken by the noise, took flight from the nearest tree. Abos watched as they circled the park before returning to the same branches and settling again. He turned to me.
"Peter and Jane are feeding the pigeons."
I nodded, wondering if it was just luck that he'd picked the right species of bird. "Yes, excellent." He walked into the park, squatting on the grass and running the backs of his hands along it, before looking at the dew on his fingers. Then he stood and went to the nearest tree.
"Squirrel," he said, as the curious creature he was walking towards sprang for the trunk and disappeared into the upper branches.
Abos put his hands on the bark, feeling its contours and examining it. I watched him for a moment, then caught something out of the corner of my eye. I turned to see Harris speaking into a radio handset. She had an earpiece, the wire curling down to her collar. She was speaking softly and glancing up at the roof of one of the surrounding buildings. I moved closer.
"Understood," she said. "Stand ready."
Her body language had changed. She was tense. Her eyes flicking across to the far side of the park, then back to Abos, who was now peeling the bark away from the trunk and examining the insects he had found there. I looked at the far entrance to the park. There was a flashing orange light as a bin lorry made its way along the huge Edwardian terrace opposite, the muffled thump of each refuse bag hitting the inside of the lorry, carrying clearly across the space. Couldn't see anything amiss. I looked back at Harris, who was listening intently to her earpiece.
"Damn it," she said.
Then I heard the sirens, far off. Difficult to tell which direction they were coming from as the sound bounced off the city's buildings. A few seconds later, and it was obvious they were heading our way. Harris was speaking into her handset again.
"Understood. Is there any way we can divert?" "No. Just monitor the situation. I will protect the asset."
She moved then, joining Abos, who was looking up at the rapidly lightening sky, watching clouds scud across the skyline.
Abos.
He turned towards her.
"We have a situation. A police pursuit is underway and is likely to pass nearby. Now there's nothing to be concerned about. Please remain calm."
Abos, as always, looked calm. We hadn't really covered high-speed pursuits in Peter and Jane Go Shopping. The sirens were loud now, and I could hear the screech of tyres on the dawn-wet tarmac. Seconds later, on the far side of the park, headlights appeared, and a large car came round the corner so fast that its rear end swiped a lamppost, smashing the vehicle's indicator. There was something about the eerie dawn calm which made this noisy intrusion even more shocking. Then I saw him. A bin man, halfway across the road, frozen in a moment of indecision, a cigarette dangling from his lips. He dropped the sack he was carrying, but as he looked up towards the oncoming car, it was obvious that he wasn't going to be able to avoid it. At the last second, the poor man threw his arms in front of his face as if to avoid seeing his own death. I turned away and heard the sound of a brief skid, followed by two distinct noises. The first, like a sudden gust of wind, quiet compared to the smash that followed. Then all I could hear was sirens. After a few more seconds, they fell silent and everything was still. I realized I'd closed my eyes. I opened them to the lazy blue flashes of the police car's lights strobing onto the path at my feet. I didn't want to see the inevitable result of the crash, so I looked toward the tree where Harris had been standing with Abos. Harris was there, looking stunned, all composure lost, her eyes fixed on the scene of the accident. Abos had gone. I turned my head and followed Harris's gaze. The source of the second, louder crash was immediately apparent. The car, fleeing the police, had driven straight into the back of the bin lorry. The skid, I had heard, may have slowed their speed a little, but not enough to prevent the front half of the car folding up, the bonnet crumpling like cardboard. One wheel had somehow been dislodged and was bouncing down the road like a child's toy. I was squinting at the occupants of the car, checking that they were moving. They were. When I saw him, Abos was standing on the far side of the square, holding the arm of the bin man I had seen a split second before the car hit him. The car that, even given the rudimentary knowledge I possess about the law of physics, must have hit him. The car that was now bent round a lorry, its engine smoking as the first drops of a rain shower began to fall. Abos had covered the distance, which was at least 50 yards, in the time it took me to turn my head about 4 inches to the side. I watched numbly as he said something to the man whose life he had just saved, nodded at the police officers who were exiting the two pursuit cars, then turned and walked back towards us. Without turning her head away from the scene, Harris whispered,
"What do you think he is, Miss Lofthouse?"
I thought for a moment before replying, as Abos got closer, his physique dwarfing anyone nearby. Behind him, the man who'd avoided death jabbered something at a police officer, pointing at the man who'd saved him.
"And you think he's on our side?"
I turned to look at Harris, but she continued to watch Abos approaching. I don't think he'd have the faintest idea what that question means. Harris's eyes flicked to the left and she swore under her breath.
"What? What is it?"
In answer, she grabbed my arm and headed for the car, waving Abos over as we walked.
"Press,"
she hissed. I looked back and saw a figure slide off the seat of a scooter, one hand reaching into a jacket pocket and pulling out a notebook.
Uh-oh.
We were hustled away quickly. Harris trying to shield Abos's body with her own so the reporter wouldn't see him. A good idea in theory, I suppose, but as he's the best part of 2 feet taller than her, not very effective in practice. In the car, McKean, who is the least talkative man I've ever known, couldn't shut up. He fired question after question at Abos, none of which seemed to be answered to his satisfaction. Next, he speculated about possible answers to his own questions in a slightly manic monologue, which, although annoying, did at least give me time to get my breathing back to normal. Harris's first question had reminded me of that which I still somehow kept conveniently forgetting. "What do you think he is?" I couldn't answer that. McKean, meanwhile, seemed to have come up with a theory that, at last, stopped him jabbering away like a 4-year-old.
"The most telling piece of evidence is surely that the clothes would have been ripped from your body if you'd run across the park at that speed. It's simple physics."
That little piece of speculation distracted me momentarily. I confess, as an image of Abos shedding his clothes as he ran came into my mind. Oh, I must get myself a boyfriend. This is getting ridiculous.
"Your skin is different to ours, Abos, but when we checked your blood, it was as human as mine. I wonder... Might it be that your skin is also human, that, in fact, other than your size, which is unusual but not unheard of, you are actually completely human in your physical makeup? If so, then either the material which made up the cylinder still surrounds your body in some way, like an invisible outer layer of skin, or..."
His voice trailed off and he stared up at the roof of the car, his mouth opening and shutting soundlessly. Harris looked like she was about to speak. I put a warning hand on her arm and shook my head. I'd seen McKean like this before. He was thinking, not having a seizure, but if you'd never seen him deep in thought, you could be forgiven if you assumed the latter. Eventually his mouth stopped moving. He smiled.
No, no, that might not be right. Another possibility is brain function. We know you're using more of your brain than the rest of us.
During the few days I'd been away, Abos had been submitted to a battery of medical tests. Father told me that one of these involved a revolutionary new piece of equipment that can photograph the brain. The scan of Abos showed activity in parts of the brain which are almost dormant in humans. Although, as Father reminded me, our understanding of human brain function is still at a primitive level. He believes this is an area of scientific research which will undergo a revolution in the next 100 years. Meanwhile, Abos may be accessing parts of the brain that the rest of us can't. McKean was warming to this idea in the car.
If it's brain function that enables you to do what you do, control your body and, to an extent, your surroundings, then you may represent the future of our species, Abos. You could be a few more steps along the evolutionary path.
He carried on speaking like this until the car came to a stop. He was only thinking out loud, but it was as if the possibilities had so excited him that he had to vocalize his thoughts or risk forgetting them. When the driver turned off the engine, he lapsed into his more customary silence, much to our relief. I've tried to convey some of what he said here, but he used terminology which was beyond me and at times babbled so quickly that I couldn't keep up. I looked out of the window. We were outside my house. Father appeared at the door. We walked down the steps and waited. When Abos got out, he smiled and shook his hand. Abos responded naturally. He was a fast learner.
Welcome to our home, Abos.
Harris and McCain waited in the kitchen while Father and I gave him the tour. I said little. It was an odd experience following them around my house, hearing it described room by room, Abos ducking as even the high Victorian lintels were too low for him. Father sounded like an estate agent showing a house to a 10-year-old foreign dignitary.
And this is the larder. In here we keep various foodstuffs and, I believe some cleaning equipment, is that right, Cress? Yes, yes, good. Some food is tinned, which seals the food in an airless environment, keeping it fresh until required. We also have dry food in here and staples such as sugar and flour. Flour can be used for the baking of bread and such like. Such like?
I believe this may have been the first time Father had seen the inside of the larder. Abel seemed particularly interested in the stairs, stopping at the bottom and looking at them, following their progress upward. I realized he had only seen one floor of station. This was the first staircase he had ever seen. After a few moments of hesitation, he followed Father up, and I trailed along behind. Father started this part of the tour in the bathroom, so I took a moment to check my bedroom. I don't know what made me do it, really, and I know I will find it hard to explain what happened next. I looked in and saw my dressing table, the jar of cream, the brush and makeup, a couple of scarves hanging on the back of the chair. The bed was made, my nightgown on the pillow. The nightgown suddenly seemed absurdly unfashionable and frumpy. In the middle of the bed was Mr. Tedkins, a stalwart of my childhood and still much loved. I felt a warm flush on my neck. My room looked like the room of a spinster, an old maid, not a woman just shy of 30. I backed out and shut the door behind me. When Father and Abos emerged from the bathroom and looked as if they might head my way, I gave a brief but firm shake of my head to Father. He looked a little confused, but steered Abos away to his own bedroom. I stayed on the landing, picking up snatches of their conversation. Abos must have asked a question.
Well, yes, indeed, it is wider than yours. This is called a double bed. You're quite right, it is designed for two people. I was married for many years, and...
Peter and Jane's mother and father are married. They love each other and have children. What is love? Although I listened carefully, as it's not just Abos who would like the answer to that one, Father did little more than stammer and cough, mentioning the human drive to reproduce and something about societal norms, then attempting to move on to a different subject. As much as I adore him, Father seems as emotionally stunted as the rest of his generation much of the time. Not that I'm one to talk.
Where is your Mrs. Lofthouse?
Oh, she died, Abos, many years ago.
What is died?
Sometimes it's easy to forget that Abos only knows what he has been told, what he has read, or what he has worked out for himself. The books I had left him with were all aimed at children under 10. None of them covered death. I heard Father begin to pace, and then stop. I walked quickly to the doorway and saw Father standing at the window looking out. Abos was behind him, reading the titles of the scientific journals on the bookshelf.
"Death is the inevitable end to life," began Father, without turning. "Taking humans as an example, we live approximately 70 to 80 years. Our bodies grow in childhood, then very gradually begin to decline. From our late 30s onward, there may be thinning of the hair, some wrinkling or flaccidity of the skin, and decreasing muscular strength. In most animals, once the ability to reproduce has gone, death follows shortly afterwards. Humans are unusual in this regard, although much of our increased longevity can be attributed to our advances in medicine and increased knowledge about the benefits of balanced nutrition and regular exercise. However, although the average lifespan of humans continues to rise, it is still limited. Death is inevitable. The body shuts down. The respiratory systems fail. The heart no longer beats. Our brains cease functioning. The body, once death has occurred, is no longer able to sustain its form and will begin to rot. We bury our dead.
After a pause, which must have lasted a few minutes, Abel spoke. The body dies, yes. What happens to the person?
The person is not the body, perhaps.
Father turned. His eyes were bright with tears. He didn't see me. I wondered, not for the first time, about the sadness he hides behind his formality. He's kind, patient, and loving towards me, but I've always felt locked out from the man that Mother must have fallen in love with. And yet here he was, opening up to someone not even human. Perhaps it's easier to be vulnerable in front of someone who can't understand your pain. I don't know. I stood in the dark hallway out of sight, watching and listening.
Perhaps. It's hardly my province, Abos. Science is my speciality. I study facts, and I only draw conclusions when the facts support them. Thus, I believe that the person is the body, and dies with it. There is no evidence to suggest otherwise.
Abos turned his head and looked at the double bed again, but said nothing. The last bit of drama occurred as we were leaving. We were about to get into the car when we realized Abos was missing. One moment he was walking down the steps towards the car, the next he was gone. He had moved so fast in Finsbury Circus that he had seemed to vanish. If he had pulled the same trick, he could be anywhere. Harris looked sick. He was her responsibility. Next door's dog saved the day. Not normally one for barking, he erupted in a burst of frenzied yapping. Mrs. Cole, our elderly neighbour, let her terrier have the run of the garden during the day, and that's where the noise was coming from. I ran up the steps and let myself in through the side gate, Harris and the others following. Our garden, like many others in this part of London, isn't large, so when I rounded the corner of the house, it only took me a couple of seconds to see that it was empty. I looked over the fence at Tupper, the terrier. He was jumping up and down with excitement, his eyes fixed on a spot above my head. I looked up. First thing I saw were the soles of a pair of army boots about 6 feet above me. They looked brand new. Abos had finally picked up the promised handmade pair a few days earlier. He was standing on thin air looking into my bedroom. He glanced down at me.
You forgot to show me your bedroom, Cress. It's very nice.
Nice. Another Peter and Jane word. For some reason it made me angry. In fact, I felt frustrated and upset, although I can't explain why.
Get down this minute!
Abos obediently floated down and joined me. By that time the others had arrived, and their expressions as he sank to the ground were full of wonder, awe, disbelief, suspicion, and fear. Harris, if possible, looked even more ill than she had when he'd vanished. She may have been considering the report she would have to deliver to Hopkins. I, meanwhile, was pointing my finger at Abos as if he was a disobedient child.
"You should not have done that, Abos. It was wrong. You should have asked me."
I spun on my heels and walked off. I've thought about it all day. I still don't know what I was so upset about.
Chapter 17. Often, you don't get to decide when one chapter of your life comes to an end, or when a new one begins. Sometimes those decisions are made for you. That's been the case for most of my life. I was an overweight, shy kid. One day, that was over. I became a young man with superpowers, trying to work out my place in the world. After that day at Tilkley Park, that was over too. I ended up working for the same secret government department that my father had worked for. Willingly, or so I thought. My memories from the moment I passed out at Tilkley Park to when I started working for Station are confused, hazy, and full of gaps. I know I spent a long period in what I thought was a hospital. After that, I moved to my own windowless room. I have no memory at all of changing my mind, trusting Hopkins and agreeing to work for Station, but it happened. The first clear recollection I have from that time is of walking into the mess hall with Hopkins and sitting with other soldiers. I was dressed like they were. I felt that this was where I belonged. That sense of belonging lasted for 4 years. Then, one terrible night in Shoreditch, that was over too. And the chapter that followed was the worst of my life. I was the only member of the crew with enhanced abilities. That made me an outsider. The other soldiers had lives beyond Station's concrete walls. Husbands or wives, partners, children, friends, hobbies. Not me. I wanted their friendship, their approval. They were my unit. And yet I can't remember a single name. Station was my life. I ate there, worked there, slept there. Station looked after me, treated me well. And they helped me manage my condition. Another early memory. They explained why it had been necessary to capture me by showing me photographs of other children of the deterrent who hadn't been as lucky. I saw rib cages torn apart by rapid, uncontrolled tissue growth. I saw the broken bodies of those who had, one day, suddenly risen into the air, able to fly but unable to stop themselves, until their power was exhausted and they fell to their deaths. I saw one girl whose brain had expanded inside her skull, pushing cartilage out of her nostrils and forcing her eyeballs from their sockets. There was a morgue one level under my quarters in Station. Hopkins showed me some of the bodies. He talked about scouring the country, searching for the deterrent's children, only to find disease and death. There'd only been one other exception. A girl they had brought in just as the symptoms of her powers started to show. Hopkins opened a folder containing a photograph of a girl in her teens, propped up in a hospital bed, smiling. We had hoped to help her survive puberty, maybe learn more about the power she had inherited. Unfortunately, she lapsed into a coma shortly after her first menstrual cycle. We kept her alive for nearly 3 months, but she never regained consciousness. It was hugely disappointing. I was still looking at the photograph, so full of life. That's terrible, I said. Then I registered the word he'd used. It broke through the customary fog of confusion I lived with at that time. Disappointing. You were disappointed.
Devastated.
He arranged his features into an approximation of sadness. Then he took the photo and slid it back into its folder. What's her name? I watched him struggle to remember.
Kate.
I had a feeling he'd just made that up. The visit to the morgue is one of the memories I was allowed to keep. There are flashes of memory from that time. Sometimes when I'm drifting off to sleep, I remember a humming sound, and a kind of buzz in my head, and a woman's voice, kind voice, telling me that Station would take care of me. Station was good. Station was right. I would feel good if I worked for Station. According to George, Station is a world leader in the use of chemically assisted suggestion programs. Brainwashing to you and me. My brain, during my 4 years working for Station, was thoroughly washed. Washed, rinsed, spun, dried, and washed again. I was one of Pavlov's dogs, salivating whenever they rang my bell, doing whatever they wanted me to do. After 6 months, I was put to work. I remember the build-up to a mission, the briefings, the preparation. But as hard as I try, I draw a blank if I try to follow a memory past the point at which Station has blocked it. The few moments I can picture are tantalizing or scary. I remember sitting in the back of a lorry with a platoon of soldiers. Once I was in the belly of a huge plane, in the dark, clipping my parachute release mechanism to a line as the cold wind roared in my ears. I remember nothing of the missions themselves. I trawled the internet since, read speculation about the assassination of certain of our country's enemies, deep in hostile territory, under seemingly impossible conditions. Was it me? Possibly. I've also seen the reports of the disappearance, or deaths, or suspected half-heroes. Me again? I wish I could be sure it wasn't. George said perhaps memory loss was a blessing in some circumstances. The only mission I remember in every terrible detail is the last one. When someone reached into my mind and pushed away all the structures station had so carefully built. When I suddenly saw what I was doing and what I had become. Chapter 18. It was 4 a.m. I was in the passenger seat of a police van. Dawn was still hours away, and despite the fact that I was keyed up, my knees bobbing up and down against the dashboard, some 4 a.m. magic still managed to seep through the tension. It's a dark, disquieting hour. It doesn't matter who you are or where you are. At 4 a.m. nothing feels entirely real, which is a good thing, as this is when the human capacity for regret and remorse is strongest. Luckily, there wasn't much time for navel-gazing. At 2 minutes past the hour, the radio on the dashboard crackled into life, and the visibly intimidated police officer crammed in beside me picked it up. Police officers speak to each other in code. I never did bother to learn what meant what. He said a couple of things along the lines of 1083 and DX7, then turned to me. Time to go. My handler was sitting in the next van along. Every mission had a handler whose job was to babysit me and, when ready, switch on my power button. The power button was another station trademark, along with brainwashing and moustaches. It contained a mixture of drugs. I know adrenaline was one of them, kept in a tiny canister inside my upper arm, ready to release its contents when triggered remotely. Hopkins told me it would help me to control my strength and aggression. This was a perfect example of station doublespeak, as it actually did the opposite. The moment my handler pushed the power button and my body experienced its effects, my inhibitions went out of the window, along with my instinct for self-preservation and personal moral code. Whatever instructions I'd been given dropped into the front of my mind, and nothing else mattered. I knew what I was going to destroy, or who I was going to kill. I dreamed of becoming superhuman. Station made me subhuman. My handler that night was an older man, with cold eyes and an expression that suggested he'd suspected someone had just farted, and I was top of his list of suspects. I'd never seen him before. I rarely saw the same handler twice. It was station's policy. He wound down the window. Ready? Yes. Wait until I reach the wall, and make sure you give me the full 5 minutes before you let anyone follow. He waited. Sir, I added. You know your route. He was excited or anxious, I couldn't tell which. I had an intuition that he was pretty high up in station's pecking order, which meant tonight's mission was a big deal. Yes, sir. Once I was in, speed would be important. The police vans faced the side of a warehouse. It was a single-floor brick building divided into 4 units. The target wasn't in the first building. She was in the third. My briefing had warned that she and her companions were not only armed, but had explosives they wouldn't hesitate to use. My briefings were always just that. Brief. The official reason was that, as an undercover operative protecting my country, it was in my own interest, as well as my nation's, that I knew the minimum needed to do the job. If I fell into enemy hands, I would have very little to tell them. Of course, the unspoken reason was that they didn't trust me. Not even pumped full of their drugs. I was the son of the deterrent. The super being supposed to usher in a new golden age of prosperity and security for Great Britain. When he'd first donned the cape, figuratively speaking, the word empire had been bandied about in certain wood-panelled private London clubs. and look how that had worked out. Unusually, I had been given more detail on this occasion. The briefing had painted an appalling picture of the group I was about to encounter. The targets were homegrown jihadists, intent on committing a terrorist atrocity. If successful, they would kill thousands of innocents. Hopkins himself had attended my briefing, saying nothing until the end. Then he'd put a hand on my arm and looked me in the eye.
Daniel, these traitors won't look like soldiers. They have to blend in with society unnoticed. They have been lying to their families, friends, neighbors, and co-workers for years while they prepare for this attack. These people will do or say anything in pursuit of their deluded ideals. Do not give them that chance. Hit them fast, hit them hard, and send a message to others of their ilk that their cowardly acts will only get them killed. He turned to go, then changed his mind, facing me once more. I'd found something to look at on the ceiling. I may be able to crush a house brick between my fingers and thumb, but something about Hopkins has always given me the willies. His moustache twitched. The good, decent folk of Great Britain can sleep easy, safe in their beds while you're around to defend them. I'm proud of you, my boy. It was the longest speech I'd ever heard him give. He put out his hand and shook mine gravely with absolute sincerity. If I hadn't spotted him using half a bottle of hand sanitizer 30 seconds later, I might even have been moved by it. As I walked towards the warehouse, its dark brick exterior lit by a single lamppost, I wondered again why he decided to add his personal authority to the briefing. I was 3 yards away from the wall. I slowed, watching and listening. The bricks looked to be the usual grimy, soot-stained variety, their layers of dirt probably dating back to the reign of Victoria. The floor was littered with sweet wrappers, dog shit, newspapers, and cheaply printed leaflets for prostitutes. The only sound was the usual London hum of traffic and fox screaming a few streets away. I reached the wall and put one hand on it. Then I waited. Back in the van, my handler pressed the button that triggered the drug's release into my veins. My pupils shrank to pinpricks before dilating again. My awareness of my surroundings dimmed for a few seconds. Then everything hummed into raw, vibrant life around me. I saw tiny insects crawling across the wall. I felt the bricks themselves vibrating under my fingers as I took 3 or 4 quick, deep breaths. The power started its inexorable build-up to unstoppable violence and temporary madness. I wonder if my handlers felt like bomber crews in military planes, the ones who pressed the button and released the payloads. Was there an emotional reaction at this grim piece of death-dealing machinery dropped away from the aircraft? What went through their minds as they dispatched a machine whose only purpose was to destroy everything it encountered? There were 4 walls between me and the terrorists in the 3rd room. I took 2 steps back, turned my shoulder towards the 1st wall, and ran straight into it. Chapter 19. I felt the wall crumble as my body followed my shoulder into the warehouse. The 1st unit was an empty shell. Rats scurried in panic as I thundered through, picking up speed. 12 seconds after breaching the outer wall, I hit the next. The interior walls weren't as thick as the exterior, and I barely slowed as I crashed through. The 2nd unit was half full of cars, stolen cars, I later concluded. There were number plates stacked on a low table at the back, and 1 corner was set aside for respraying vehicles. There were 3 rows of cars between me and the targets, the last row parked against the far wall. A gap had been left behind the cars as a walkway. If I had been capable of making logical decisions at that point, I might have swerved onto the walkway and hit the wall there. As it was, my mind was empty of anything other than the desire to run, to punch and kick, to tear apart, to crush, to pulverize. Mindful gurus might do well to consider what was going on in my brain, as I was a model disciple. When you are washing up, just be washing up. When you are eating your breakfast, just be eating your breakfast.
when you were violently maiming and killing people. Just be violently maiming and killing people. I don't imagine they'll be featuring me in any commercials. I jumped as I got close to the first row of cars. Then three metal-crunching big paces took me to the wall. It was a freakishly destructive hop, skip, and jump. After landing on the bonnet of the bright red Mazda, I hopped onto the Ford Focus, then skipped to a Range Rover. In all three cases, denting the cars beneath my feet, from the Range Rover I leaped at the wall. The element of surprise had been slightly lost by the amount of noise I'd made. In an explosion of brickwork and plasterboard, I hurtled into the room and landed on the floor, rolling and standing up in a movement Station had made me practice so often. It had a kind of balletic grace, even when I did it. I scanned the room. It looked like a terrorist cell should look, according to my briefing. Camp beds along the wall, four of them. Rudimentary washing facilities in the near right-hand corner. A screened-off area, possibly a shower. A big table in the far right corner, with the remains of a meal on it. Two people sitting there, looking up in shock. To my left, a man rolled off another bed. He was scrabbling around at his feet, reaching for a shotgun. I ran at him before he could lift an aim. I was almost close enough to swing my first punch when something hit my left shoulder and spun me to one side. I skidded on the concrete floor and looked behind me. Another man had appeared from the screened area. He raised a hand and slapped the air in front of him, as if swatting a fly. 10 yards away, I felt a blow to the side of my face that rocked me. I paused for half a second, confused, then roared with fury. At that stage, I was still in there somewhere, still able to direct my behavior. I can't. I won't pretend otherwise. "Christ, Kerry," said the one who'd slapped the air. "He's strong. How could he be that strong?" He raised both hands this time and swiveled as if he were an Olympic hopeful swinging an invisible hammer. As his clenched fist came around, I felt a blow on the side of my head that made me take a correcting step to the side. And that was when the balance shifted past the point of no return. The firework display began inside my head. All I could do was watch the show. I was no longer in control. I turned to the nearest hostile. He pumped the shotgun and fired into my chest. I was pushed backwards by the impact. I almost fell and screamed with pain. Shotguns hurt. My other attacker used this distraction to hit me again with whatever it was he was hitting me with. I think the blow might have done more damage if I hadn't been pushed out of position by the shotgun. It felt like someone had slapped my ear and something skimmed the side of my head. I grabbed the smoking shotgun by the barrels. It was still hot. I jabbed at him with the stock and heard his skull crack before he fell. If his brain had survived the force of the blow, it wouldn't be good for much from now on. I heard a woman's voice screaming something over and over. The other figure at the table with her was standing now, keeping his body between the screaming woman and me. I turned and ran for the second attacker, picking up anything I could find and throwing it at him as I approached. A mattress, a saucepan, a suitcase, a pile of books, they all flew towards him. Nothing hit him, despite the speed and accuracy behind my throws. He held his hands in front of his face and seemed to brush them aside before they reached him. Not that it had made much difference, because by the time he had deflected the last book, I was on him. I didn't waste time on niceties. I was here to kill terrorists. Somehow, this man had hurt me. I punched his ribcage through his lungs and heart. His expression as he died was one of shock and frustration. Now, it was 2-1. Not good odds for them. I ran towards the table and met the final man halfway. My fist was raised when my power-fueled brain decoded what it was the woman was screaming, over and over. "Daniel! Daniel!" For a split second, my brain re-engaged and allowed a coherent thought to materialize. How? How did she know my name? My hesitation was tiny, but enough to allow my assailant to throw the first punch. Which wouldn't normally bother me. This punch bothered me. My head snapped back, and I tasted blood. Enraged and incredulous, I flung myself onto him. I can't describe the fight that followed. It's not that I don't want to or can't bring myself to detail the struggle between us. It's just that I was on such a power high that I had no idea what I was doing. I was a raging, screaming, super-strong killing machine with no way of stopping. He was about my age, broad, incredibly strong, just not as strong as me. After a few minutes filled with the savage, grim sounds of a fight to the death, I pulled myself up from the floor, my hands wet with blood. The final target was still sitting at the table, looking at me. She had stopped screaming during the fight. Her expression was numb, but her voice, when she spoke, was surprisingly calm. "Daniel, I know it's hard for you to hear me, but I need you to try. Daniel, please." By then, I was at the stage where language had little meaning. As the power surged, my rational mind retreated, until little capacity for thought remained. The power was everything, my self-awareness virtually gone. The final stage was unconsciousness. My strength burned out like a tissue thrown into a roaring fire. I felt a moment of confusion at the fact that I could understand her words. As I walked towards her, I could sense my power reaching the end of its surge, the heavy, irresistible wariness pulling at the edges of my awareness. I would have to be quick. "Daniel, I know what station is doing to you. This is not who you are." I stopped. A sudden flash of anger, confusion, fear, and shame shot through me. I looked at her properly. She was short, had long red hair, pulled back into a ponytail. Green eyes. She looked tired, scared, and desperately sad. I took another step towards her. "I know how you felt when your power first kicked in. I know how scared you were that morning when your bed collapsed. When you looked in the mirror and saw a new face appearing. The day you asked your mum to tell you the truth about your father." I stopped again and shook my head. How is this possible? How could this crazy jihadist know about me? How was I able to think at all? Every other mission had ended with me unconscious after the power had run its course. This was different. Something in her voice had reached through the fog and found me. I felt the exhaustion tug at me, more insistent now. There was no time. I stepped forward and put my hand around her neck. I could make it quick, at least. "You're not the only one, Daniel. Think about it. You're being used." She seemed unafraid as I prepared to squeeze. Once again, I hesitated. "You must fight what they're doing to you. They drug you to keep you compliant. Wait." My hand was still at her throat, but I didn't tighten my grip. Waves of exhaustion were coming faster now. Soon I wouldn't be able to stand. She looked as exhausted as I felt. She was finding it difficult to speak, sweat breaking out on her brow, her breath shortening. She put her hands on mine. "Daniel, look around you." I looked back at the carnage I'd left in my wake, followed the direction of her gaze. She was staring at the body of the final terrorist, the strong one. His face was swollen and bloody. I felt cold shock numb my senses. When he had attacked me, I'd seen a stranger, bearded and wild-eyed, the face of a crazed terrorist, a fanatic. Now I saw him as he was, underneath the damage I had inflicted. It wasn't the face of a stranger. He looked so much more like me. Could have been my brother. What had I done? The woman's voice reached me as if she was speaking from the end of a long tunnel. With a huge effort, I wrenched my attention back to her. "Your masters at station are not your friends, Daniel. You are not helping your country. Look around you. What did station tell you? Who do you think we are? We're..." She stopped, then took two quick, horrible, rasping breaths before her head fell backwards. That was when I saw the bullet hole in her neck and the hot red blood arching away from the wound, spattering the table and the pages of the book she had been reading as she slumped sideways, her life ebbing away. I sank to my knees, the unstoppable debilitation finally claiming me. I fell sideways to the floor, and through a curtain of red rain, watched my handler walk towards the table, his cold eyes focused somewhere beyond me, his right hand holding my pistol.
Chapter 20. September 9th, 1978. The news broke this morning. No photograph, so much of the piece comes across as conjecture, but still. It's unhelpful. Whatever Abos is, or may become, he's not ready for the intense attention that would ensue if his existence were to become common knowledge. I just wrote if, but it's when. A secret this big is too big for even the most secret of the British secret agencies. One day soon, everyone will know him. And I will have lost him. The Peace by Justin Needham may make his name when the rest of the world catches on as the first documented public sighting of Abos. Although if Mr. Needham is serious about his career as a journalist, he will have to go easier on the wild speculation. It's almost laughable. Almost. I have the newspaper clipping. The Daily Herald, Saturday, September 9th, 1978. A real superhero, and he's British, by Justin Needham, crime reporter. A dawn raid on Hoxton's, one of Old Broad Street's most exclusive jewellers, ended in dramatic fashion yesterday when a mysterious superhuman figure intervened. A police chase had closed in on the two thieves' getaway vehicle in Finsbury Circus when they crashed into a refuse lorry on its morning round. The two suspects in the robbery, Barry Gregory, 42, and Kevin Innes, 28, were taken to nearby Royal London Hospital, where they were treated for whiplash and minor injuries before being remanded in custody. This is the third raid on a London jeweller's in the last 4 months, and a police source confirmed they were confident the pair were behind the earlier crimes. However, the crash that ended the criminal's spree has an incredible twist, which would be almost impossible to believe if were it not for the presence of witnesses. Council worker Fred Ward, 51, was standing directly in the path of the getaway car when it drove around the southwest side of Finsbury Circus at speeds approaching 65 miles per hour.
"I left it too late to run," Mr. Ward told me minutes after the incident. "I knew my number was up. I closed my eyes and I waited for the car to hit me."
What happened next was seen by two independent witnesses. Before the car hit Mr. Ward, a man from the park lifted him off his feet and brought him across the road to safety. An amazing act of heroism, but there's more to this story. No one saw the man anywhere near the road before the crash. In fact, all three witnesses insist he wasn't there. The speed at which he ran was so fast that no one actually saw the moment he saved Mr. Ward. And although there is some confusion about what this mysterious stranger looks like, on one point all accounts agree. He is the tallest, biggest man they've ever seen. Mrs. Sylvia Lewis, 63, watched from her bedroom window as the car approached. She described what happened.
"I can still hardly believe it, to tell you the truth. If it had been night time, I bet you'd have thought I'd been drinking, but at that time in the morning, well, sober as a judge I was. As a judge. I saw the car hit the bin lorry and I thought to myself, 'Oh, well, that's it, Silly's a goner, isn't he? He'll be all squashed and such like. Awful.' So I had a good look, but I couldn't see him at all. Just the car all smashed up. Then stone me, but I look down and he's on the pavement underneath my window, chatting to this big bloke he was, thanking him like. And I'm telling you, as God is my witness, the big fella wasn't there when I first looked out of my window. I swear it. I reckon that bin man had a guardian angel and I saw him."
Terry Gannon, 31, is a colleague of Mr. Ward's and had just collected the bin from number 30 Finsbury Circus. He was on the other side of the lorry when the thieves' car crashed into it.
"I didn't see nothing because the lorry was in the way, right? Not until Fred appeared on the pavement with that massive bloke. I mean, you've got to understand, this bloke is huge, right? You ain't ever seen nothing like the size of him. That giant haystacks on the telly would look like a midget against this bloke. About 10 foot high. I'm telling you, almost as wide, too. Built like a brick. Well, you know, like a brick. Like a brick."
He talked to Fred for a minute and then he walked off.
"I reckon he's a science experiment by the army or something. He was wearing green like a soldier. Maybe he's, you know, one of them test tube babies or something." Have to be a bloody big test tube, mind you.
Mr. Ward got the closest to his mysterious benefactor, but admitted he was so shaken up that he couldn't take it all in.
"Well, he was big, I remember that. Looked a bit like James Bond, only really, really tall. And he hardly spoke. I know he must have been running like a blinking Olympic sprinter to get me out of the way of that car, and he had to pick me up, but he wasn't even out of breath. I kept thanking him and thanking him. Couldn't believe I was alive, could I?